Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 19. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the riches of your words, and I pray that you would help us to mine those riches well and meditate well, discipline our minds to take in your word. Please help me to speak your words under the control of your Holy Spirit. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Well, as we pick back up on the story of David returning to his throne in Jerusalem after Absalom's revolt, we find Shimei and the Ziba Mephibosheth duo, the same Israelites that had made parting shots at David on his way out of Israel. They're now waiting for him at the Jordan River, at the border of the country, hats in hand, as it were, as David comes back into Israel. And I want to look at these two characters and see what we can learn from them. Let me read through this passage. I'm going to start at verse 15, 2 Samuel 19, starting at verse 15. Then the king began the return and came up from the Jordan, up to the Jordan. And Judah went toward Gilgal to go call on the king in order to bring the king over the Jordan. And Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to call upon David, the king. And 1,000 men from Benjamin were with him, including Ziba, the manservant of the house of Saul, with his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they advanced across the Jordan in front of the king. And when the ferry began crossing over to bring the king's household over and to do whatever was good in his eyes, Shimei, son of Gera, dropped down in front of the king while he was crossing over in the Jordan. And he said to the king, "Don't reckon iniquity to me, my master. And don't remember how your servant produced iniquity on that day when my master the king went out from Jerusalem, for the king to harbor it in his heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Now see, today I have come, the first of all the household of Joseph, to come down in order to call upon my master the king." Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, responded and said, "Shouldn't Shimei be put to death over this? For he made light of the Lord's anointed one." But David said, "What do I have in common with y'all, sons of Zeruiah, that y'all should become prosecutorial for me today? Shall a man be put to death in Israel today? Indeed, don't I know that I'm king over Israel today?" Then the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." Thus the king swore to him. Mephibosheth, grandson of Saul, also came down to call upon the king. Now he had not tended to his feet, nor had he tended to his facial hair, and he had not washed his clothes from the day of the king's going until the day when he arrived in peace. And it happened, when Jerusalem went to call upon the king, that the king said to him, "Why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth?" And he said, "My master, the king, my own servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, 'Let me saddle the donkey for myself, and then I will ride on it and go with the king, for your servant is crippled.' So he went under false pretenses against your servant to my master, the king. Nevertheless, my master, the king, is like an angel of God. So do what is good in your eyes. For the entire household of my father would not exist except as dead men before your my master, the king. Yet you place your servant with those who ate at your table. And so, why should there be for me any more of a right to cry out any more to the king?" Then the king said to him, "Why should you speak of your matters anymore? Y'all, you and Ziba, shall share the estate. I have spoken." So Mephibosheth said to the king, "Better yet, let him take the entirety. after such time as my master the king has come in peace to his palace. I'll stop there. This passage naturally divides into two sections. One, profiling Shimei's attempt to reconcile his previous offense against David by means of a humble confession and restitution. And the other, profiling Mephibosheth's attempt to reconcile with David by means of passive trust in David's mercy. Now, there is no consensus among Bible scholars as to whether Shimei and Mephibosheth did the right thing here. Bible commentators were on both sides of the issue. Some of them said yes, some of them said no, they were lying. But I do think we can learn good lessons from Shimei about how to resolve conflicts with fellow human beings. And I think we can learn a lot about how to get right with God through Mephibosheth's example. Let me start with Shimei's example of conflict resolution with other human beings. When we studied chapter 16, we read the story of Shimei cursing and insulting King David and his followers and throwing rocks at them as they fled from Absalom out of Jerusalem through the town of Bahurim, where he lived in the hill country of Benjamin. And at that time, David was struggling with despair. He was entertaining the thought that Absalom was legitimately the new king. He was calling Absalom the king. He was entertaining the possibility that God had even inspired Shimei to curse him as a parting shot. So David had meekly endured Shimei's insults back then. But now it's become clear that Absalom's coup was not under God's blessing. Instead, Absalom was dead, and God had turned the hearts of Israel to reinstate David as king. And of course, this left Shimei in a very dangerous position politically. David is about to cross the Jordan River out of his place of exile and march his soldiers right through Shimei's hometown of Bahurim into Jerusalem to reclaim his throne. Well, what's David going to do? We know David could be a hothead. Back in chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, David had vowed to kill every male resident in Nabal's compound over a lesser insult than what Shimei had given David. Even if David could keep his head cool, his army officers were another matter entirely. Chances were Joab or Abishai, who'd already tried to kill Shimei once back in chapter 16, would conveniently avenge David on their way through Bahurim by assassinating Shimei, whether or not David approved. So verse 16 tells us Shimei had to hurry, act quickly to save his skin. Acting quickly to resolve a problem that you created is important. Jesus also spoke of the value of acting quickly to resolve a dispute. In Matthew 5:25, he said, "Get on good terms with your accuser quickly, even while you're with him on the road, lest it happen to be you that the accuser delivers over to the judge, and you be thrown into prison." Agree with your adversary quickly. Letting an offense fester undealt with will only make the matter worse. Thank you. In addition to acting quickly, Shimei did something tangible to prove his change of heart. He didn't come down from his hometown in the hills to meet David down at the Jordan River with nothing but empty words. He brought 1,000 men with him to support David. And I imagine it was no small feat to get 1,000 men to quit their work for the day and walk 20 miles down to the next town in order to do a special errand for him. And then there's the 20 miles walking back. I mean, he got 1,000 men to really go out of their way. Perhaps what perhaps what Shimei lacked in wisdom and trustworthiness, he made up for in zeal. He really must have feverishly recruited all this welcoming party just as zealously as he had earlier been so zealous to pelt David's company with rocks. He channeled his zeal in a good direction. This crowd of Benjamites then began setting up a system to get David and all his people safely across the Jordan River, a ferry system, maybe a pontoon boat system, something, a pontoon bridge system or something, maybe just a chain of people to stand and pass things over their shoulders. We don't know exactly. But they were there to honor David as highly as possible, giving him first-class treatment. And while they're doing that, Shimei makes a beeline across the Jordan River toward David and asks for pardon. The Hebrew wording here could be interpreted that Shimei actually bowed down in the muddy shallows of the Jordan River, face down in the river in front of David before David was carried across. Shimei spared himself no dignity. He was desperate. When we've offended someone else, we need to be ready to humble ourselves in order to ask for forgiveness, even if it means getting mud on our face. Three times Shimei calls David my master, my lord. Twice Shimei calls himself David's servant, your servant. And twice Shimei calls David my king. Shimei wants to quickly establish where he is in relationship to David, humbling himself before David. He's no longer a rebel, wanting to do his own thing, refusing to acknowledge David's kingship like he was. He's now David's servant, committed to honoring David as Lord and King. Shimei also acknowledges that the thing he did was wrong. He says, I have sinned. It's very important, if you've done wrong, to confess sin rather than to make excuses for yourself, rather than minimizing what you did, rather than ignoring it. The person you sinned against, whether it was God or somebody else, they know you did them wrong. And if you act like you didn't do anything wrong, that makes the offense even worse. And so he asks David three times to no longer consider him an offender. He says, don't reckon iniquity to me. Don't remember how your servant committed iniquity that day. Don't harbor this grudge in your heart. Asking forgiveness is part of making an offense right. Now, the other person might not be ready to forgive you, but you do need to give them the opportunity to forgive you by asking for it. And wow, what a burden it is off of both of your minds if they do forgive you. Shimei's offer of restitution would restore the damage of dishonor which he had done to his king. He rushes to be the first to welcome David back to Israel as king. If Shimei had waited until David had marched into Bahurim and arrested him at his house and then offered this apology, there would have been reason to question his sincerity. But since Shimei had already taken actions with 1,000 men to honor David before begging pardon, his apology is much more believable. Maybe he had a change of heart and was no longer a rebel. But David's nephew Abishai isn't convinced. He'd already reached the point of wanting to kill Shimei back in chapter 16. He said, why should this dead dog curse my master the king? Let me go over and remove his head. Now a second time he suggests to David it's time to put Shimei to death. Though Abishai is a little more restrained this time, he says, shouldn't Shimei be put to death? In doing this, Abishai takes up the role of an accuser against Shimei, and this turns David into a judge, and it's appropriate for the king to be a judge in their system of government. So he's become the accuser in a court case by saying this. He has made light of the Lord's anointed. He has cursed the Lord's anointed. Shouldn't he be put to death? Now, what's David going to decide as judge? Will he honor Shimei's request for mercy and take the risk of allowing this loose cannon to remain in his kingdom and signal tolerance towards everyone who had opposed him in the recent civil war? Or is he going to honor Abishai's request for justice and put to death the man who had grievously insulted him, making an example of him for all who would dare speak against his authority as king? David decided in favor of mercy. And he tells Abishai, "Hey, I appreciate your zeal to protect my honor, but just because you're my nephew doesn't mean you have to prosecute everybody that insults me." And further, David reasons that enough as blood has already just been spilled in the civil war. This day needs to be of an opposite character. Nobody should be put to death David's first day back in office. It should be a day of rejoicing, day of peace, a time of healing. So David chose to forgive where he could have pursued punishment against his offender. I think this is largely due in part to the way Shimei sought resolution through his quickness to reconcile, his tangible restitution, his humbling himself, his confession of sin, and his plea for forgiveness. The second person who approaches David on his way across back into the country is Mephibosheth. Unlike Shimei, Mephibosheth decides to deny his sin and take a passive approach, which simply expects David to show him mercy. Let's see how that works. In chapter 9, verse 13, and in chapter 16, verse 3, we read that Mephibosheth resided in Jerusalem, in David's palace. Jerusalem was located on a high hill, so whenever anyone travels in the Bible from Jerusalem to anywhere else, the Hebrew verb is he went down, because literally that's what they did. They went down the hill. The way the Latin and Hebrew and Arabic Bibles read of this passage, and the way the NAS, NIV, and New Living Translation edited it, verses 24 and 25 could both refer to a single trip which Mephibosheth made from Jerusalem down to the Jordan River to meet David. That's the point of this slide. You don't have to digest everything that's on the slide. But where the highlighting is the same color, it's the same word going across the different versions and translations, okay? I interpret it that way, the way the NAS, NIV, and NLT did. One trip from Jerusalem down to the Jordan River, and that's where he meets David. However, the way the Septuagint Greek and Aramaic Targum, Syriac, King James, and ESV edited it, Mephibosheth's audience with David happened during the journey back up to Jerusalem, or even after David's return to Jerusalem. I don't think this is an important, it really doesn't make a difference when it happened. I'm just pointing out, if your translation is a little different from the way I'm interpreting things, this is my explanation for why that is. At any rate, Mephibosheth presents himself in a startling condition when he met up with the king. He had not washed his clothes, and he hadn't brushed his hair the whole time David had been gone from Jerusalem. Well, we don't have enough timestamps in this history to calculate exactly how long that had been, but it had been many days at least, enough time for Mephibosheth to start looking and smelling bad, probably. And when David sees Mephibosheth, he gives him the opportunity to defend himself, although David's question does have an accusatory tone to it. why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? Because on that fateful day in chapter 15, when David had fled from Jerusalem, he had gathered all his followers, including women and children. And they had all gone out together. So why wasn't Mephibosheth there? Why didn't he go out with them? Mephibosheth's answer shifts all the blame to his servant. And it also focuses on his own pitiful dependence on David's favor. Mephibosheth calls himself your servant, that is David's servant, and he claims that he had spoken to his servant, Ziba, whom David had assigned to be his servant, and claims that he had commanded Ziba to let him strap a saddle around a donkey for himself so that he could follow David out of Jerusalem on that donkey. Now, if this is true, then when Ziba gave those donkeys as a gift to David on his way out of Jerusalem, one of those donkeys was Mephibosheth's donkey. And since Ziba had taken Mephibosheth's donkey and given it to David, Mephibosheth had not been able to follow David out of the city because he was lame and he could only travel on the donkey. Mephibosheth paints himself as a helpless victim. And then he claims that Ziba played the part of an enemy spy against him by slandering him and telling David that he had remained in Jerusalem because he thought he would be crowned king after David. Now, according to verse 17, Ziba is standing nearby. He hears what Mephibosheth is accusing him of. And we don't have any howls of protest from Ziba recorded here. I like the way this artist painted the picture. Ziba, he's hearing Mephibosheth give his explanation. He's like, oh, good grief. But it may be that since Ziba is not objecting, maybe Mephibosheth's account is true. It's really hard to tell, and Bible scholars are divided on whether he was telling the truth or not. But there's also problems with what Mephibosheth said. Everybody in David's palace, except for those 10 concubines that were assigned to stay behind and keep the palace, everybody was ready and waiting to go with David according to what the palace manager had said in 2 Samuel 15:15. He'd said, "Behold, your servants are ready." Why wasn't Mephibosheth ready? Where was he? Presumably he was in the palace that day. He'd been given time to get ready. There were servants that could have carried him. Why didn't he go with David? Secondly, the nature of the master-slave relationship in the biblical system of slavery was such that if a servant didn't obey his master, it was his master's own problem. It was not anybody else's problem but his own. It just meant he was a poor manager. The master was responsible for the behavior of his servants. If they didn't obey him, he had the authority to discipline them. It was his responsibility to train them to do what was right. Yeah, sure, Mephibosheth was probably frustrated with Ziba, but Mephibosheth wasn't a victim. He was the master in this relationship. So for a prince among the king's sons to place all the blame for his failure to support David upon one act of disobedience by one of his servants is simply not a reasonable explanation. So in addition to shifting the blame and not admitting fault, Mephibosheth, without having done anything to show support for David except to go along with this crowd when they welcome David back, simply appeals to his dependence upon David to show him favor. He reminds David that he's a cripple, as though David couldn't see that. He also recalls that David had spared his life, even though he was part of the family of the former king Saul. So instead of killing all of Saul's heirs, and despite the uprising against David in Ishbosheth's brief stand in Machanaim, David had still spared Mephibosheth's life. And what's more, David had offered to provide for all of Mephibosheth's needs like a son for the rest of his life. Mephibosheth says with his words that he's a servant of David. David will be his master and king. But he really doesn't have anything more than his words to back that up. Now, there is some plausibility in the fact that as dependent as he is, it wouldn't make sense if he were to bite the hand that fed him, as it were, and rebel against David if he's depending on David's for food. He's probably not likely to do anything to alienate himself from David. But Mephibosheth's words are kind of slippery. He claims he had no right to cry out to the king when, in fact, it's what he's just done. The Hebrew word in verse 28, translated cry out or appeal or complain or ask, means to object to an injustice or to plead with an authority to make something right. That's exactly what Mephibosheth just did, complaining to the king about being double-crossed by a servant. And yet, then he says, oh, but I have no right. I'll let you decide. Mephibosheth just passively waits for David to decide whether or not to show any more kindness to him, hoping David will take pity on him. He says, you're an angel of God, therefore do what is good in your eyes. Mephibosheth's character doesn't seem to be particularly respectable. He's a bit of a freeloader and seems to just do nothing. Perhaps he is immersed in self-pity over his lame feet. Perhaps he's immersed in self-pity over this sense of the tragicness of being the lone surviving heir of Saul's house. Ziba's accusation is... the servant, Ziba's negative portrayal of Mephibosheth is plausible considering Mephibosheth's character. But on the other hand, Mephibosheth's unkempt appearance tends to support his claim. If he had been thinking he would be crowned king, he must have been disabused of that notion pretty quickly and gone into mourning quickly under David's overthrow. It's really not clear whether either Ziba or Mephibosheth were telling the whole truth. But what is clear is that there's this power struggle going on between Ziba and Mephibosheth. They're mighty quick to cast aspersions on each other. I don't think David trusted either Mephibosheth or Ziba. Again, commentators debate on that, but I think David could tell they were both fudging on the truth here and there in order to convince him to give one or the other of them the edge over the other. And David just isn't interested in playing that game. And I think that explains David's pretty terse answer. David answers Mephibosheth's closing question with a question, as if to say, well, if you say you have no right to cry out against this injustice, why should I consider your complaint? I'll give you one more ruling, and that's it. Because back in chapter 9, David had ruled that Mephibosheth would be given all that had once belonged to King Saul, his grandfather. Now, in chapter 6, so then later on in chapter 16, when Ziba had accused Mephibosheth of treason, David had given to Ziba all that had belonged to Mephibosheth. Now David says, share Saul's estate between the two of you. Now, again, this is a subject of debate. Bible scholars debate whether this is a new ruling where each of them would own half of Saul's estate, or whether this was a return to the first ruling where they would both live off the proceeds of the estate, but Mephibosheth would technically be the owner and Ziba would technically be the manager. But after ruling on it this third time, I get the impression David's lost patience with both Mephibosheth and Ziba, and he's not going to mediate their squabbles anymore. And so from here on out, they're just going to have to work it out for themselves. The picture I get in my mind of Mephibosheth and Ziba is from the end of the Disney cartoon Robin Hood, where the greedy Prince John and his reptilian sidekick Hiss spend their last scene blaming each other for their downfall, chasing each other around with a stick while the castle's burning down around them. Maybe that was actually inspired by Punch and Judy, but that's the mental image I get of these two guys. They're just going to continue fighting while their whole estate burns down around them. And I think Mephibosheth saw that outcome too. And so he did some quick figuring. If he were to give his full estate to Ziba, that would satisfy Ziba, because that's all Ziba wanted was the wealth. And Ziba then would settle down in Gibeon, where Saul's holdings were, which would be, you know, a good, at least a whole day's journey away from Jerusalem to the north. Meanwhile, if Mephibosheth could live in David's palace again in Jerusalem with all his needs met, like David had previously offered him in chapter 9, then he'd be a safe distance away from Ziba, and he could live in peace with David's family, and he'd be set for the rest of his life. So Mephibosheth counterproposes that Ziba take it all once David is settled back on his throne in Jerusalem. And we don't hear anything more about Mephibosheth again in the Bible. Don't know for sure what happened. We do get a flashback in chapter 21 to a previous bit of his history. But I think Mephibosheth resumed residence at David's table and didn't make any more trouble. I think that's generally what people believe happened. So what do we think of Mephibosheth's approach, this passive approach of expecting mercy? That was risky. Might not have worked with a lot of people. But I submit to you that it worked in this case because of the nature of his covenant relationship with David. David had told him, "You've got a seat at my table with my sons." And because of who David was, David is the Lord's anointed who had the character to forgive and to show mercy to someone who was just a mess. So when we offend a fellow human being, especially when there has been very little relationship between us, such as might be the case if you were to crash into somebody else on the highway, we would do well to follow the example of Shimei with David by acting quickly to resolve the conflict, making tangible restitution, humbling yourself, confessing your sin, asking for forgiveness. But what if your offense is against God? He says, "You shall have no other gods before me, and the soul that sins, it shall die." And yet, in our self-centeredness, we forget that he even exists. And we selfishly do things for our own pleasure and reputation. Our hearts are like idol factories, coveting things, coveting relationships, coveting experiences for ourselves. Speaking a mixture of lies and truth. And then we catch ourselves and realize, how am I going to smooth this over with God? I can't fool him and say, it wasn't my fault. I can't change myself and be good enough to be acceptable to him for the rest of eternity. He said that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And I can't give him anything to appease him for my offenses, because he owns everything, because he created it all. Offering him something would be like if I were to wreck somebody else's car and then rip the door handle off their car and hand it to them and say, here's a gift to make up for me wrecking your car. It's ludicrous. We're not really in a position to make it right when we have offended God. And so I submit to you that when we've offended God, Mephibosheth's example actually sets a good example for us of how to approach that. We can do what Mephibosheth did, come to the Lord's anointed, the successor to David, Jesus, and say, Lord, I am your servant, and your servant is lame. I can't make this right. Me and my family, we're worthy of eternal death. And yet, you have so graciously told me I could eat at your table with your children. So here I am. I've just placed myself at your mercy again. And remember your covenant with me. And I ask that you do what you believe is good. You see how once again David is a type of Christ who chooses to have mercy on those he wants to show mercy to, who turns rebellious enemies into sons, who feeds them at his table, and who receives them back in love when they cast themselves upon his mercy. Whether or not Mephibosheth had integrity, we can adopt Mephibosheth's strategy when we come before Jesus the Messiah, because of who Jesus is and because of the nature of his covenant with us.